And now it's time to go to the full phones. The full phone lines are open, and I'm joined once again by Dayana Yoakum, our personal finance expert here at The Motley Fool. Dayana, welcome.
Thanks, David. The phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL, and we're going to Birmingham, Alabama, and Zafir is on the line. Hi, Zafir.
Hi.
How are you?
Michael, I'm good, thanks.
Good. What's on your mind?
Actually, I have a question regarding primarily preserving capital and increasing my savings that I have for retirement.
Okay.
And the issue is that I'm a Muslim, and most scholars forbid taking interest for us. So, I mean, we cannot invest in CDs or companies like banks or even retailers which sell alcohol. So mm-hmm. we're somewhat limited, and so I wanted to get your input about it.
Yeah, Zafir, this is an interesting question. Can you educate us a bit? What is it about the idea of not taking interest? What is that rooted in?
I think in the 6th century, a lot of people were giving interest, and then it was being compounded, and the poor people were never able to pay off their debts because they ended up paying up more in interest than in actual principal.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of compounded the problem, and then it pretty much was outlawed or whatever.
Mm. It's a fascinating question. Certainly, high interest rates have been a problem in many different societies and cultures over the years. I think the word usury was given to those practices, particularly in Western medieval times, and was outlawed by the Christian church, the Catholic church, for a while, certainly. And the practice of taking interest, I guess everybody has a different viewpoint on it. From our standpoint, well, I guess part of American culture is just this idea that, you know, if you give something to somebody else, they pay you back more later on. That's why you'd give it to them. Mm-hmm. But I completely can see, Zafir, the cultural roots of what you're describing, and I respect the what must be quite a difficult thing to try to figure out how to get a good return. I think you said preserve your capital, didn't you?
Yeah, because if with the inflation, it goes down if I have cash lying out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fascinating. That's right. Inflation is the cost of holding cash. It usually erodes the value of what you hold by 1 to 4 percentage points year in and year out. And so you're asking, how do you invest your money for retirement?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, let me ask you this. Can you own stocks?
Yeah, own stocks. But again, we have to be careful in terms of like stocks, which like banking stocks or financial companies or even retailers like Walmart or Target, which sell alcohol. We need to stay away from them.
So. Understood. So, you know, obviously a lot of people are interested in what's called socially responsible investing, where they invest in companies that they can believe in that accord with their own beliefs, whatever they are. And that's really what you're describing here. You're saying even avoiding companies that would sell alcohol is part of your socially responsible investing approach, and I understand that. Let me ask you this. Some companies make a fair profit and choose to pay a portion of that profit back to investors in the form of a dividend. Do you understand dividends, and would that be...
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I mean, that is fine, and that is probably why buying stocks is not prohibited, because you buy part of the company and you're not just giving somebody money in the form of, and then asking return in the form of interest.
That's right, and that's why, Zafir and Dayana, what I would probably do, were I in Zafir's situation, I would probably lean toward investing in good, safe, stable companies, becoming a part owner through their stock. Of course, companies that I believe in that accord with my own beliefs, what they sell, which is true of all of us, by the way, I think should be. That's the way I invest, too. And I'd favor ones that pay a dividend. Because what that means, Zafir, is over the course of time, you will be getting paid something back to compete with inflation, you know, in the form of that annual dividend, just a portion of the profit that the company is paying back to its part owners. That's what dividends are. And so you can find good, stable companies that pay increasing dividends over the years, and often those are some of the better stocks in America as well. There are certainly services out there that focus on dividend investing, companies that pay good dividends. Zafir, that's where I would start sniffing around looking for good investment possibilities.
Okay.
Now, the home run here would, of course, be looking for a company that pays dividends, but is also, you know, falls under that moniker of socially responsible investing. And,
you're right.
And interestingly enough, that trend is actually getting very popular. It has over the past, I would say, decade.
And
there are mutual funds that call themselves socially responsible funds because they invest in companies that do not, say, sell firearms or alcohol.
Yes, but here's the problem there. That is that in the end, that's a sort of a one-stop shop answer. Mm-hmm. And if I'm Zafir, I can't just buy any good socially responsible fund off the shelf. Probably does have banks and financial services, companies that do pay interest. And whoever I am, whoever each of us is, I think the most socially responsible way to invest is to buy stock directly. Because when you buy a socially responsible mutual fund, you are buying somebody else's opinion that you have no control over. You don't exactly know how your money's being invested, and you probably are never going to have a good heart-to-heart conversation with that manager and figure out if you and he or she believe the same thing.
That's true, David, but you can read the prospectus. Remember, there is a lot of information in there.
And also, I've glanced at some of these socially responsible mutual funds, and they have not done well as compared to the market.
That's another thing, Zafir, and that's because typically those mutual fund studies have shown have higher annual costs just to run the funds, and of course those costs get passed on to the investors who end up with below market returns, partly because of those additional costs.
Thank you. Appreciate your help.
That was the hope, Zafir, that we could provide you some help, and I want to send you off by mentioning again dividend reinvestment plan, something we talk on the show, where you can buy shares in a company, register with that company, and buy future shares of that company directly. And even have your dividends converted into share ownership if that's what you want to do. So looking into so-called DRIPs, dividend reinvestment plans, something else that if I were Zafir in Birmingham, Alabama, with a good question on my mind, I'd probably be looking there too.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Good luck, sir.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Steve.
Hey, what's happening?
Pleasure to have you on the show. What's on your mind?
Okay, well, the question I wanted to ask about was on choosing stock brokers.
Okay.
I've had a broker for about a year now, and we're not doing anything too complicated. I'm just saving up for a mortgage account. And I was wondering about this. I find him kind of incomprehensible a lot of the time.
Okay, so are you talking about one particular person at the firm or anytime you walk into the firm? And by the way, do you walk into the firm?
I do walk in. He's like an independent contractor, I guess. He's a broker with a big company, and I guess the way it works is he's licensed by them.
Okay.
So I don't know if it counts as a firm or not.
And you're trying to build up enough money to make a down payment on a new house?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So why is he incomprehensible? Or can you give me an example of a word or phrase that he'll keep throwing out there?
Well, the thing is, he just generally speaks in very technical language. And since I'm so new to the field, I have a hard time understanding some of the things.
Okay, so we're going to call him Sammy the stockbroker. Let's keep talking about Sammy then. So are you thinking about switching away from Sammy? Is this the thought?
Yeah. But the main issue I'm wondering about is whether communication issues are indicative of competence issues when it comes to money management. That is to say, my inability to understand the technical language may not have anything to do with his ability to adequately manage money.
Fair.
That is a very interesting observation and I think a very astute one. So it sounds like you're wondering, are you and Sammy the stockbroker a good match? is this an investing match made in heaven or not?
Right.
I think, and this, of course, comes from my bias as an undergraduate English major, but I think language really counts for a lot. And I think that somebody's ability to speak to you in a way that's comprehensible to you reflects positively on them or negatively on them, and that you should draw the proper conclusion. So I believe that Sammy the stockbroker should be able to speak to you in a way that you can completely understand.
And
to the extent that Sammy is unable to do that, I mean, you could ask that Sammy. Step number one for you, I would say, Steve, is ask Sammy if he can be more comprehensible. If he can be, then he's probably a good broker. If he cannot be, there are two possibilities, both of which would cause me to fire him. The first is that he just can't speak well with you. And because it's a communications-based relationship in a lot of cases with your broker, fire him. Or number two, he's not speaking comprehensively because he himself doesn't exactly understand the field or the product. And by the way, he wouldn't be the first broker that we could say that of. And I can say that of any professional in almost any industry, by the way. I'm not picking on brokers here. But Sammy, if Sammy cannot communicate effectively with you, I would say that's probably a major, that's the death blow to your relationship right there.
It would be different if I'd had the guy for, let's say, 10 years. I could evaluate him on the basis of the actual money management. But since it's only been a year, I find myself, this is sort of the only way I can evaluate whether I want to keep him.
That's right.
And I'm just not sure if I'm jumping the gun on that.
One measure of a broker's competence is how that broker communicates.
I agree with that.
His customer. And remember, this is your money. So if you don't know what's happening with your money or what decisions are being made or what you're being advised,
that's potentially a dangerous situation.
Then that is, after 2 weeks, 2 days, you would not be jumping the gun if your broker couldn't fix that situation.
I think what we're talking about here, Steve, is giving Sammy, again, step one, give Sammy a better chance or the final solid opportunity to be effective for you and with you. If Sammy is unable to achieve that, then it comes down to not so much that you're going to fire Sammy on principle, but I think you're looking around at other options. And the best reasons to fire a professional is because we found a better professional. And I know there are some good brokers out there. And I also know that if you're feeling comfortable or interested in getting more educated on the subject, you can probably ultimately hire a discount broker, pay a lot less, because you're not needing the advice. But it doesn't sound like that's where you are right now.
No, I'm too new to the field. I need somebody who, you know, genuinely can make good on all the promises of the investment banking commercials, that they'll actually understand me on a personal level.
Well, yeah, for that you need to have an obligatory four-year-old child that you can throw up in slow motion next to the lake. And if you don't have that four-year-old, you're not going to realize that vision quite yet.
True. Good point.
But all facetiousness aside, I think step one, give Sammy the test. Step two, if Sammy fails the test, talk to his manager and find out if there's somebody better positioned at that firm, if you're comfortable with that firm, who would be more effective. You probably just kind of got assigned Sammy as you walked in the door, but there's no reason that ultimately that needs to be the only person at that firm that you're working with.
Good point.
So that's step two. If you can't really find anybody, step three is start to float out to your friends, family, professionals in your life this idea that you're going to switch brokers. And by the way, who do you use, and do you like him or her?
It's kind of like asking to be set up with a friend's friend.
That's good, Dan. I agree with that.
We're talking fish in the sea, brokers in the sea, you know, right. Potential.
Could you introduce me to Sally?
That's right. Hey, I'm in the market.
You know, there's a lot of truth there. So, Steve, have we given you an action plan here?
Absolutely. Mostly, I think you've confirmed what I already suspected, so I appreciate that.
Okay, good. I wish you the best, and I do encourage you to give us a call back and tell us what you've learned in the meantime, because it's a question, yours is a question that many people have.
All right, fantastic.
We'd love to learn. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Talk to you later, Steve. Bye-bye. The phone number is 866-NPR-FOOL. Let's go to Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello, Lisa.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a couple questions. Number one, I have a 14-year-old and a 6-month-old, and my husband is constantly telling us we need to save for the future. We have a number of different accounts. We both have a 401k. We have a savings account with about 4.5 months savings in it. We have a college 529 plan. We have savings accounts for both of our children for college. And we're trying to get a gauge as to if we're average, below average, above average in terms of our savings to debt ratio. We don't carry any credit card debt. We do have a car and a mortgage, but that's it.
Okay.
Lisa is in a situation that a lot of people find themselves in. They've got a lot of financial issues, a lot of money questions, and a lot of places where their dollars could be allocated. And Lisa, it actually sounds like you're doing pretty good. You have no credit card debt. You might be happy to know that the average household that has debt has around $11,000 of credit card debt.
Of credit card debt.
Yep. Mm. And in America, the average household is paying $1,000 in interest a year on that debt. So, number one, you're ahead of most Americans in that regard.
Great.
You've also started saving some, which is great. I don't know how much you have saved, but one sort of sad statistic that I've seen lately is that 3 out of 4 workers ages 55 to 64 have less than $60,000 saved for their retirement.
Ages 55 to 64?
Yeah, so we're talking people who are very close to retirement. Now, it sounds like you're a lot younger and that you do have savings in a 401k plan. So
we do, and we have collectively about $130,000.
Great, great.
So, Lisa, it sounds like you're stacking up pretty well against most Americans. There was another part to your question.
My next question is, when should I seek a financial advisor, and what's the best way for me to go about finding the right person?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and a lot of us need a second opinion to answer all of those questions that we have about our money.
Why do we need a second opinion, Dan?
Well, first of all, it's nice to bounce a couple ideas off of someone, and also these are people whose full-time jobs are to know the laws and know the ins and outs of investing and of savings and of tax consequences of your financial
needs. Yeah, and many times they're not actually being compensated in some cases the way that you or I might want them to, and that can taint their advice if they're actually trying to sell us something from their firm as opposed to thinking about what is the best answer for you and for me. So I guess by seeking a second opinion, you increase your odds of finding somebody who's not conflicted.
That is true. David's taking the pessimistic approach here. And Lisa, it depends on what kind of financial advice you're seeking. There are several kinds of pros out there. Financial advisors or financial planners, those are the generalists of the field. They'll look at your overall financial picture, your 529 plans, your cash savings that you've got socked away, your investments, your debts, and all the big areas of your money life. What you're looking for here is someone who can objectively put your finances into context. And this is the important part, and this is what David was getting to, is not compensated based on how many products they sell you, what they sell you, but that they make their money based on a flat fee.
Per hour from you.
Per hour.
Lisa, does that sound like where you are right now, what you'd like?
Yes, that sounds great. Now, where's the best place to find that person?
Well, start with asking around.
Okay.
Find out if friends or family members have a financial planner that they like, that they've used over the years, that they trust.
NAPFA.org, yeah. The National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, has a website, and I'm pretty sure you can tap in. I haven't done this recently, so I'm doing this from memory, but I believe, Lisa, you can tap in your city and state and find a list of people that would possibly fit your needs.
Right.
Okay, great.
Now, this is a very important part of your shopping process for a pro. This is an uncomfortable thing for people to do. You might find someone who has all the right professional designations, but you have to ask the question outright, how do you get paid? That is very important because it's going to color the kind of financial advice that they give you.
Yeah, it's a good, direct, short question to ask early in any interview. And by the way, it's worth mentioning as we close here, Diana, that in a lot of cases you can have that first hour is free usually, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you consult with a financial planner, you're not actually already being charged in that first hour.
That's right. Most of them want your business anyways, and they're willing to give you an hour of their time and probably will wow you with some glossy charts and interesting insights, and what you want to do is weigh those insights. You can shop around, go to a couple people, see who you feel comfortable with and who you think actually understands your money questions.
Mm-hmm. Great. This is wonderful advice. I will be sure to ask, how do you get paid first?
That's right.
That's a great way to go. I wish everyone in America knew that. And Lisa, thank you very much for sharing some of your story. Good luck to you and your husband and your family.
Thanks so much.
And that wraps up the Fool Phones for this week. That's all we have for you. Diana, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, David.